Superchargers, headlights, and more. With over 122 million parts, eBay Motors has everything you need to maintain your vehicle and level it up to peak performance. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, your part is guaranteed to fit your ride every time or your money back. Stay on your A-game with all the parts you need at the prices you want. It's easy to bring home huge wins. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply. See ebaymotors.com.
Welcome to Something to Wrestle With. Bruce Pritchard.
Bruce Pritchard.
Well, you know.
That's not a rib.
She pooted.
She pooted.
What a rib.
No, you have a meal.
There's no box of gimmicks.
Rumor and innuendo.
I don't deal in rumor and innuendo.
And
was he there? I was there. I don't give a shit. I ain't scared of shit.
I ain't scared of shit.
Fuck him.
Fuck you, Bruce.
I love you.
Give me double cheeseburger. Double cheese.
Hey, it's Conrad Thompson, and you're listening to Something to Wrestle With from Tokyo. I know that's not exactly what you expected to hear today. We're calling an audible. We had originally planned to do a Saturday night's main event watch-along from Hulk Hogan and King Kong Bundy all the way back in 1988. And then we put the poll up, and you guys were so fired up about Royal Rumble 99, I said, oh, well, we'll just do that one next week instead. And then something tragic happened. We lost Mean Gene Okerlund. And you guys wanted some Mean Gene content today, and that's what we're going to bring to you. But unfortunately, I'm in Tokyo, and Bruce is in Friendswood, Texas. And he's going to be in Friendswood again this weekend with Eric Bischoff and half a dozen other, or maybe two dozen other, WWE Hall of Famers. You got to check him out at the Baybrook Mall, Fitterman Sports. It's Saturday, January 5th. So tomorrow, if you're listening to this on Friday, but Ted DiBiase, Bushwhacker Luke, Nasty Boys, Demolition, even our main man, Eric Bischoff. And rumor and innuendo, Bruce, is that Honky Tonk Man might be there. This might be the first time Honky Tonk Man and Eric Bischoff have been in the same place since Bischoff's been running him down over on 83 weeks.
Well, it should be interesting, to say the least, and we are all going to be there. It's a small place, so it should be an awful lot of fun and awful explosive, to say the least.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to the reports. I'm sure social media will blow up on that. And hopefully you're doing what I'm doing and you're watching Wrestle Kingdom today. I know that we've been promoting it here on Fight, and I ran into Mike Weber at the Tokyo Dome, and he is all excited about the show. And I'm sure the reviews that people are seeing right now tell the story. But our story continues. You know, before we get into Mean Gene, let's tell you where we're going to be coming soon. January 19th, Colorado Springs. I can't believe we're finally making our way there, but I'm looking forward to that one. And then, just a week later, we're going to be in San Diego at the world-famous Madhouse Comedy Club. That's an afternoon show. And then, of course, on Royal Rumble Sunday, we're in Phoenix at Stand Up Live. Been looking forward to that one for a long time. We'll put the band back together in March. We're probably going to drip out a couple of February shows. Stay tuned there. But March 1st, it'll be Bruce Pritchard, Eric Bischoff, and myself. Looking forward to that. In Connecticut. We've never been to Connecticut before, and this is at the Mohegan Sun. If you can't have fun there, you're dead. You can get tickets for all of these shows at brucepritchard.com. And don't forget, the solo tour for Bruce Pritchard in Australia also on sale now. He'll be there in late March, the 22nd, 23rd, and 24th, which is Sydney, Melbourne, and Brisbane. So you got to be on top of these live events, man. They're sneaking up on you. It's brucepritchard.com. And Bruce, one of the things I wanted to do on this show is take maybe a little bit of a different approach, because sometimes I like to cross-examine you, and that's not really what today's going to be about. I just want to celebrate the life and times of Mean Gene Okerlund. You know, one of the things I was thinking about is, hey, we're going to cover the good, the bad, and the ugly. With Mean Gene, there is no bad, there is no ugly.
Yeah, I can't think of any ugly with Gene.
Yeah, I can't think of any bad. You know, obviously he had some health issues, but he's one of those rare guys I never heard anybody say a bad word about.
No, you're not going to either. And Gene Okerlund was a friend, he was a colleague, and it was educational to get to be around Gene all those years, and I thoroughly enjoyed every single second of it.
Well, let's start from the beginning. Gene was born Eugene Arthur Okerlund on December 19th, 1942, in South Dakota, of all places. And he grew up, he described himself as a semi-wrestling fan. He would watch it when it came on late night in the 50s. Of course, he's watching AWA up there. And then eventually, when he goes to college, he goes to the University of Nebraska with a guy who would go on to be the Baron, Baron Von Raschke. Any good early Mean Gene wrestling stories you can remember? Because it feels like back in that day, everybody had a favorite or a moment or a memory. I mean, even now, I guess, I can point to live events and be like, that's when I was a wrestling fan.
You know, I guess back in the day during that time, especially in that area, it was all about Vern Gagne. It was all about the AWA. And growing up in that area, if you didn't know who Vern Gagne was, he was more popular than the Pope in many ways. So it was, that was a big deal then. And that was the guy. That's who Gene grew up on.
You know, he didn't just jump right into the wrestling business, though, which I think a lot of people assume that that was always the plan, but it really wasn't. He graduates college and goes into radio, which makes sense. I mean, he had one hell of a voice, and he's winding up at KOIL in Omaha, Nebraska. Eventually moves up to Minneapolis and continues in radio, has about a 9-year run there. And he also starts eventually selling for a television station in Minneapolis, and television sales. That's not an easy sell, is it, Bruce?
No, it isn't. But at the same time, when you are a salesman, okay? So you know a great salesman when you meet him. And Gene Okerlund was the epitome of salesman. He was constantly selling, which made him such a great pitchman. And that's why he was such a good interviewer, because he knew what points to hit to get people interested in the product and make them get off their sofa and come down and see the live events.
Well, and so that's sort of how this all happened. You know, I feel like we've told a similar story on 83 Weeks with Eric Bischoff, where he talked about how the announcer for the AWA was arrested for DUI, couldn't make a shot, and then they asked the guy in ad sales who had a good look, come hold this microphone. And that's how Eric Bischoff got into wrestling. And Mean Gene, oddly enough, has a somewhat similar story where the AWA is doing a live show every Saturday night, and there's a guy named Marty O'Neill who's the announcer for the AWA. And one day he's ill and can't come to work. So they asked Gene to come in and host the AWA that day. And Gene has said he didn't really know much about wrestling as far as what to call the moves or the holds. And Vern told him to just sit down and call what you see. And Gene said that's probably the best advice he'd ever gotten. The story of how this is really just a happy accident and Mean Gene winds up in the wrestling business is incredible, is it not?
Yeah, it is. And it's funny because that story is so similar to a lot of the greats when you go back and you find out how they all began. I'll go back to Paul Bosch. When Paul Bosch first started his broadcasting career, he was listening to the commentators, and the commentators were calling the wrong holds. And Paul started to tell him what the correct holds were, and the guy just handed him a microphone. In this case, Gene was the voice, didn't know what the hell he was going to do, because you feel that, okay, I need to know something about it. And Vern gave him the best advice that he could give him. Just call what you see. Call what's in front of you and describe the action. And you can either do it or you can't.
One of the things I found fascinating in my research is that Gene admitted that one of the things he really struggled with was trying to predict what was going to happen. And he felt like that was part of his job, was to sort of anticipate the next major move or the next break in the action, whatever. But he says that the real key to his success was to figure out how to stop doing that and instead just call something once it happened. Is that something that you guys talked about a lot in Vince McMahon's WWE?
That's the key to every great play-by-play guy. Don't anticipate. And that's the problem with commentators in the wrestling business that know the finish or know the storyline, because they're trying to lead you. If all you have to do is call what's in front of you and call what's on your monitor at the time, then you're not going to screw up. If it doesn't happen, you don't call it. But if you make something happen that isn't there, it comes across as untrue. And that's the best advice anybody can ever give you.
No doubt about it. What do you know of Vern's relationship with Gene? I mean, it does feel like, you know, we've heard various reports through the years about how Vern could be sort of bitter when one of his guys that he really made a name moves on. And certainly that's going to be the way things wind up for Vern and Gene. Do you think that they reconciled, or how would you categorize their relationship?
Well, they did reconcile over the years when Vern was inducted into the Hall of Fame and everything with the WWF at the time. I know that they had reconciled there and they were friendly. But it's business, and sometimes you have to make a business decision and move on. With Vern Gagne, you were either with him or against him. And I don't know that they certainly weren't friends at the time, but they got over it, and you move on with your life. And Vern, from what I understand, could be difficult to work with, but he was a perfectionist, and you can't argue with the success that he had during the heyday.
Yeah, and even back then, Gene was a bit of an entrepreneur. You know, even when he was in the AWA, it wasn't his only gig. He was also doing an ad agency and continuing that salesmanship. And that salesmanship, we know, is going to serve him well as wrestling fans, because we're all familiar with the hotline plugs that he really made famous. And one of the things that, before I even think about the hotline plugs, I always think about is Mean Gene in the back and doing the stand-up interviews. And that's where he got the nickname Mean Gene, when he was doing that in the AWA with Jesse Ventura. And Jesse is explaining to Gene that he was up all night partying with Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers. And then he asked Gene if he knew who Tom Petty was. And allegedly, Gene said something like, "He's a famous race car driver, right?"
He isn't.
Confusing him with Richard Petty.
Yeah.
And immediately, Jesse says, "That was Mean Gene." And what do you know? Mean Gene stuck. And I don't know that Gene really loved the name, but it certainly served its purpose. I mean, you say Mean Gene and people know who that is.
They certainly do, and it worked really well for Gene all those years. So I think that Jesse really did him a favor by giving him that moniker, Mean Gene. And overall, when you look at the person that probably got that over, the credit has to go to Hulk Hogan, because Hulk is the one that made it universal. And Mean Gene, let me tell you something, brother. And when people do interviews and they start to go into whatever impersonation they want to do, it's, "We'll tell you something, Mean Gene." It's so easy. It rolls off the tongue, and it made a hell of a career for Gene Okerlund.
It's crazy when you think about the amount of talent that rolled through the AWA, because, you know, I'm sitting here thinking, he worked with he being Mean Gene, pronouns pal. He worked with Hogan in the AWA. He worked with Bobby Heenan in the AWA. He worked with Jesse Ventura in the AWA. Then you think about all the other talent, you know, that, I mean, Ric Flair learned how to wrestle in the AWA from Vern, and he learned, or he also taught Ricky Steamboat. There's so many just phenomenal all-time world-class talents who came through the AWA that eventually really made their lot in life somewhere else. But the two that I always associate with Gene, I don't know why this is Hulk Hogan and Bobby Heenan. Both of them meet in the AWA. How would you categorize the Bobby Heenan and Mean Gene relationship?
Well, they were, first of all, they were business. They worked together, and they were friends outside of wrestling, going all the way back to Minneapolis. Bobby and Gene were very close friends. And then in later years, they both lived outside of Tampa, Florida, and they were very close. Their wives were close. Their families were close. And it was a friendship just garnered over many years, being in the same business and being able to share the same ups and downs of the wrestling business.
It's so crazy when you think about it too, about just how long those guys' careers were. And you think about AWA, they're there at the same time. WWF, they're there at the same time. WCW, they're there at the same time. All but 4 years of their career are together. Is that not insane?
Yeah, it really, it's crazy, especially in the wrestling business, that you're able to have that long of a run with the same people.
So let's get to, you know, why we all probably are listening to this and remember Mean Gene. He jumps to the WWF. And Gene said that until about mid-83, when Vince McMahon first came to him and told him about this vision that he had and talked to Gene about how cable TV was becoming a thing and how they could go national. Gene said that Vince never mentioned anything about being global, as the WWF would later go on to be, obviously. I mean, they make more money internationally than domestically these days, I'm sure. But one of the things that I've always found fascinating is sort of this old school mentality that existed back then. Of course, now, with the benefit of hindsight, we know how it wound up. But Gene dismissed this idea when Vince first lays out the vision because he doesn't understand how this could possibly work logistically. And because he had a full-time gig doing the ad agency, he wasn't willing to throw away his other business in order to try to make a run at this opportunity with Vince. So Vince cuts a deal that allows Gene to work 3 days every 3 weeks. And then he got some urging from his old friends, Pat Patterson and Hulk Hogan, and he eventually made the jump. But obviously, money played a major role in that decision as well. So not only could Vince offer him more money, but that's the best schedule ever in the history of wrestling, is it not? 3 days every 3 weeks?
Well, the idea behind it was they recorded television every 3 weeks. So during that time, that would be the time that Gene would cut all of the individual interviews with the talent for the individual markets for the next 3 weeks. Now, it was a grueling 3 days during that time that they eventually would have to take on the road and expand the number of days because the number of live events expanded. So as Gene's role expanded and the events expanded, the demand also came on him that he had to work a whole hell of a lot more. But working 3 days every 3 weeks is a hell of a proposition.
No doubt about it. And he jumps at the chance and he accepts that offer in December of 1983. And here's sort of what I was alluding to earlier. The big sit down comes where Gene has to let the Gagnes know that he's leaving. And he's not just telling Vern, Greg's there as well. And Greg is pretty fired up about it and says, "How can you leave us now? We need you. We've taken care of you for 13 years. And allegedly, Gene replied, "I've taken care of you, and this guy comes to me with an offer that's substantially better, and I don't hear any counter offers here." And allegedly, intentions run high, and Greg said something like, "Well, if it's so damn good, then take the job." So Gene did, and that was it. He was out. This conversation happened a lot in the AWA in this era when Vince was taking over, did it not?
Yeah, I imagine it did. I know that a lot of guys didn't want to give Vern their notice because they didn't feel he deserved it. And they felt that Vern had kind of taken advantage over the years. And he, like Bill Watts, a lot of times they weren't the most well-liked guys to work for. Regardless, it was standard, man. You give your notice and you work out your notice on the other side. I think a lot of talent blamed Vince McMahon, saying that Vince paid him extra. Vince told him not to fulfill their dates. But in all my years knowing Vince McMahon, I've never heard him ever say to anybody, "Don't fulfill your dates and don't honor your obligations to the other end," because he would expect it from them on the other side. So I think that a lot of guys just use that as an excuse to jump ship and get out of there. But Gene was a businessman, and Gene did it the right way by going and sitting down with Vern and saying, "Hey, I'm going to leave. Here's my notice."
Let's talk about the next time we hear about Vern and Gene and Vince. It's 1984, and obviously the WWF is blowing up now. They're on track to make WrestleMania a phenomenon, rock and wrestling and MTV. I mean, it's really, really hitting. The toys are coming. The vision is becoming reality. And during a visit to Minneapolis, Vince McMahon visits Mean Gene's ad agency and, using the phone on Gene's desk, makes an offer to Vern to buy out the AWA, allegedly for $10 million, which would be $500,000 a year for 5 years to both Vern and Greg, which is not, I mean, which means he's not going to, you know, just front load all the money. But he's offering a chance to collaborate, not buy you out necessarily, but we're going to work together and I'll give you some towns to run and I'll give you some exposure on national TV, but you can work with me rather than against me. And allegedly, Gene sees Vern blow up on the phone to the point that Vince has to pull the receiver away from his head, and he can hear Vern yelling through the headset. Things like, blow it out your ass, and it'll be a cold day in hell before I ever do anything like that. And if your only your father knew what you were doing right now. I mean, lots of resentment and contempt, and people are not happy about the move that Vince is doing. Here's my question, though. When I read this, I wondered, why would he do that in front of Gene? Do you have an answer for that? I mean, you know Vince better than anybody. Why would you make an offer like that in front of Gene to sort of undercut any sort of hurt feelings or weird emotions or whatever that Gene may have about leaving a 13-year employer? Or why make the call in front of Gene?
Well, first of all, you have a witness there. So you have a witness to him making an offer to buy him out and an offer to work with them and to collaborate. So anything that Byrne says or anybody else wants to come back and say that Vince did this or Vince did that and it was malicious on his part, he's got a witness right there that can say, no, you know what? He called the guy. He made an offer to him to work together and try and work this thing out. So that's why he's got someone to tell that story.
When he finally comes into the WWF, he starts as a commentator. He's actually doing color commentary, and he's replacing Pat Patterson. That doesn't last very long. He realizes his shortcomings, and then he starts doing the interviews. And before we get into, you know, the rest of the run there, I do want to talk about Pat Patterson as a color commentator, because that feels like that is in the book of bad ideas, especially if it's in English.
Well, no, it was – good God, he was better than Bruno. And Bruno only said a couple of words, but it was a way, it was actually colorful. And I think that it was Vince's way of entertaining himself sometimes to try and get Pat to pronounce certain things like Rio de Janeiro that Pat just shortened to, I thought better take a Rio. So it was entertaining, at least for Vince.
That's so fascinating to me that this is a guy who is all about business, but every now and again, it's cool with making a silly decision just to have fun. That's Vince McMahon.
But it was also Pat Patterson, who people, they were used to him, and they were used to him talking. And he did give good insight. For us listening to Pat, we like to make fun of it. But for a wrestling fan that is sitting there, they're listening to the first Intercontinental Champion give his views. He's not doing color commentary like what you hear now. He's doing an analyst. Vince is throwing things to him every once in a while, and it's a different voice. But Pat had credibility in that role.
One of the things everybody's been talking about is the August 26, 1984, is where we see, in Minneapolis, by the way, Mean Gene make his in-ring debut. He has his first match. He's teaming with Hulk Hogan to take on Mr. Fuji and George the Animal Steel. But what's memorable about this is not necessarily the match, but the series of vignettes that were done before the match. There was a scene where we see Gene sitting at his dining room table smoking a cigar, and Hogan comes in and gets on him about smoking, and then he takes him into the kitchen and drinks a bunch of raw eggs, just cracks them open in a glass and chugs it down. Of course, Mean Gene wants nothing to do with that. And you see people running through a park, and you see them at the gym. Just a series of classic vignettes that really are almost like a precursor for the way you guys use vignettes to introduce new characters. When I go back and I watch this, I think, boy, this was phase one before we had, you know, the Mr. Perfect vignettes or the Million Dollar Man vignettes. This was, you know, wrestling being presented in a different way, but in a way that made it much bigger. Fair to say?
It was also taking a local storyline, which was Hulk and George the Animal Steel, including Gene in it, in Minneapolis, but being able to do all of those vignettes on a national basis on All American Wrestling and TNT that got that story out and made Gene a larger-than-life character as well. But if you, whatever you do, you go back and you want to look at anything classic Mean Gene Okerlund or classic early WWF, go back and watch these vignettes. They're some of the most entertaining things that you will do all week long, guaranteed. It looks like the scenes, like in the kitchen and at the kitchen table, were shot in a trailer, quite frankly. And they probably were, knowing Nelson Swegler back then. But it was highly entertaining and holds up to this day. It's just some really entertaining, fun stuff.
Let's talk a little bit about the idea of him being so closely associated with Hulk Hogan. Is it mostly because of these series of vignettes, do you think?
No, I think that it's because, you know, Gene was the guy standing next to Hulk Hogan for all those years. Gene helped Hulk Hogan as much as Hulk helped Gene. He was the pitch man. He was the guy that was presenting, you know, Hulk Hogan and Hulkamania from the AWA, and then, you know, seemingly came over with Hulk to the WWF. So it was a package in a lot of respects. They're just very identifiable with each other.
Of course, after the passing, everybody shared a lot of their memories on social media. Hulk Hogan wrote, "The best partner I ever had. We never rehearsed or did anything scripted from a writer. Gene would just ask me, 'Hey, big man, what do you want to do?' And I would always answer, 'Just follow you, brother.' And it worked from 1980 to 2017. RIP, my brother, HH." It is sort of weird that Mean Gene, because I think people really come down on two sides of this. Like, either they remember Mean Gene from the WWF with Hulk Hogan, or they remember Mean Gene from Ric Flair and the way he would yell, "Mean by God, Gene," and all that. How many guys had a career where really there's, you know, we've talked about this a lot with Hogan, the most over babyface and then later the most over heel, just, you know, drew major money on both sides. But Gene sort of did that, not necessarily as a babyface or heel, but in two territories where nobody else really did that to that degree, did they?
I would throw Bobby Heenan in there. I'd even throw Savage in there. But there were, you know, there were a few guys, but none to the extent I think that Gene Okerlund was able to define that role in every company that he ever was in, from AWA to WWF to WCW. I think Gene was the mold, man. Gene was what everybody aspired to be.
No, you're exactly right. And you know, I would challenge you on Macho Man. I think Macho Man had a much more significant run in the WWF than WCW. And I think you could even say that for Bobby Heenan. I think Bobby Heenan in the WWF was on top of his game. By the time WCW rolled around, it just wasn't the same. And maybe some of that is because we saw so much of them, and Gene's appearances were more sporadic, and you know, maybe less is more. I don't know, but it's just fascinating to me because depending on the age of my friend, I know which Mean Gene. You know, if you're my age, you remember the Hulk Hogan stuff, but if you're 10 years younger, it's all about the WCW years. Let's talk a little bit about what's going on in the WWF. He's got lots of famous interactions because this is during the rock and wrestling era. So you've got shows where Mr. T is around as well. What did Gene think of the influence of the mainstream on professional wrestling? It feels like something he would have been a proponent for.
He enjoyed it. I think that the most infamous was the Billy Martin vignettes that they shot out in San Diego, where Gene shows up to work with Billy Martin, and Billy is sitting at the bar absolutely trashed, and Gene's trying to get something out of him. But Gene relished those moments. Gene relished taking the impossible and making something out of it. But that was probably his favorite, going, "I walk in and this guy's sitting at the bar, hammered, three sheets to the wind. I'm like, what the hell am I supposed to do with this guy? Let's turn the goddamn camera on. Let's go." And that was Gene. It was, "Let's get it done. Let's go. I'll do it for him." So I think that Gene kind of relished working with those folks. And he was, again, that conduit to the other side.
I like that you said, "Let's get it done," because that was the attitude that I think he took during WrestleMania. I didn't even know that since I started doing some research. Is this true? He sang the national anthem at WrestleMania 1?
Yeah,
like
he did.
The first one?
Sure as hell did.
That's unbelievable to me. You know, the rumor and innuendo was that they had a major name lined up, and he winds up, whoever that person is, wound up no-showing. And they're in a pinch, and Gene says, "I'll do it." And he did. That's a little footnote in history that, you know, I didn't know. I mean, I know you've told us before that Howard Finkel came up with the name WrestleMania, but the idea that Mean Gene sang the national anthem at the first one somehow was an even bigger mind blower to me, because I just never would have imagined Gene as a crooner.
Oh yeah, definitely, man. Gene loved to sing. And was Gene was one of those guys at a party when they would play piano, that Gene would be right next to the piano player singing songs. Absolute classic, man. He did it at Vince's Christmas parties. When the guy would sit down at the piano, Gene would be at the other end singing songs. You'd be in a bar somewhere, and they would have a piano, and somebody would start to play, and Gene would... It was absolutely great. Multi-talented.
Well, let's skip forward here. We've spent a lot of time talking about what happened before you knew Gene and before you had met Gene. What was your impression of Gene before you met him? And we've talked about this before. You came to work for the company after WrestleMania III in 1987, but you had been seeing some of these vignettes that they were doing with Hulk Hogan, and you had seen, obviously, his work in the AWA and now with the WWF. In your, like, way back machine, what was the rap on Gene in Texas and in the Paul Bosch territory, and how was he regarded and thought of when you actually make the trip up there?
Well, I think Paul Bosch kind of looked at him, and it was funny because Paul would sit there with a notepad and write down some of the adjectives that Gene would use to describe the action and describe different things. How ridiculous is this? So I looked at Gene as an unbelievable pitch man, and I did those stand-up interviews in the Mid-South, so Gene was somebody that I looked to try and steal from, because he was regarded as the best. He wasn't just – he was the best. So I tried to steal things from him, little nuances that he did, and that's who you stole from. So I respected him. I didn't know him. I knew that he'd worked for Vern, but I didn't know him from Adam. And I was excited. That was one of the people when you go up there that you want to meet and get to know.
Well, you met a workhorse. I think most people remember back in the day, one of the things they did is they cut what I think people refer to as localized promos, where it would be this Friday night at the Garden, Sting, you're going down, whatever. And then they run that in all the different local markets, you know, whenever they have the syndicated shows here. Well, allegedly, one of the first places they really settle in on doing these big loops like this is in San Diego. We've actually got a listener of the show here who was involved with bicycling the tapes back and forth. They would shoot a lot of them out there. They had a spot they were comfortable in and knew who to call to get the tapes around, blah, blah, blah. He said once, Mean Gene said once, he did 141 localized promos the same day. It was one of these San Diego marathon shooting sessions. You figure 141 promos, roughly 3 minutes each. You're talking about over 7 hours worth before breaks, before retakes, before, you know, setting up the bit or planning or lunch. It's 7 hours.
No, see, you make it sound like we're doing one of our shows. No, it was Howard Finkel with the book and sheets of paper with the localized interviews, and it was Gene and a room full of talent. And Howard would say, all right, now we're doing Wichita, Kansas on Monday, April 5th. And here's the arena, here's who you're wrestling with, here's the card. They would tape the card up on the bottom of the camera. And Howard would say, okay, look around the room and go, all right, we're going to do Ricky Steamboat. You're wrestling Jake the Snake Roberts. And Gene would look at the card and go, all right, Wichita, we're coming to you this Friday night. You're not going to want to miss this one. The Hulkster is going to be in town, and he's going to be taking on King Kong Bundy. And then from there, Demolition, blah, 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 blah. And Ricky Steamboat, come on, join me, my friend. You're going to be taking on the Snake, Jake Roberts. Ricky would talk for however long he would talk. Gene would fill the rest of that, and they would go on to the next one. And that's how those damn things were done at that time. There was no writing. There was no scripts. It was Howard sitting there with his book and the list of towns with the syndicated markets saying, okay, this television show airs on Saturday night. I mean, on Saturday morning. The show is going to be on Saturday night. So this one, and you make reference to tonight or the week before, you're making reference to next week, next Saturday, right here. And it was just told to him, and he would digest it and knock it out. That's how they did it. And you would do that. You would start about 8 o'clock in the morning, and you would go until about 10 o'clock at night. One right after the other, after the other, after the other, after the other.
Let's talk about the television show, All American Wrestling. He was the host of that show, and they had a few different little skits on the show. Sometimes he would interact with staff members and get their opinions on what's going on in the WWF, and other times he'd be on the phone, or at least pretending to be on the phone with a famous celebrity, and then occasionally someone would stop by. You got any stories about All American Wrestling and some of these different shows?
You know, All American Wrestling is what Vince started off with, where he got all the tapes and where he really got to know all of the other talent in the different territories around the country, because they would send their tapes and they wanted their guys to be on All American Wrestling. So they would play tapes from Junkyard Dog and from Hulk Hogan and from Jimmy Snuka and all these guys from all over different parts. And then Vince would reach out and bring these guys in. But later on, and as Gene would always say, when the ratings started to tank, that's when Vince would hand it off. And All American Wrestling had kind of reached a plateau, and Vince handed it off to Gene. And Gene relished that idea. We would tape All American Wrestling in the Edit One. Before that, we did it at in Baltimore at the studio there. But it was Gene standing in a room, and we would do 3 weeks at a time. He's standing in a room and do ins and outs of matches. And he would just ad-lib it. Here's where we're going to, Gene. He would ad-lib. But he wanted to have some creative freedom, and Vince agreed to let Gene have 1 minute, 60 seconds per show. Gene, do whatever you want. And Gene liked to do these little skits on the phone where he would be calling someone, and you would only hear one side of the conversation. Like, well, hello, Bert. How you doing there? Gene. Okerlund. Yeah, tell Lonnie I said hello. And he would have these conversations and whatever was topical in the news at the time. So that was Gene's 1 minute. We let him kind of do whatever he wanted. After a while, I had stopped being hands-on producing that show, and I let another producer take over that show. And I get a phone call one day from Vince. You know, we had 8 hours of television every single week, brand new programming every week, and I didn't watch every single edition of every show that came out. But on one of the versions of All American Wrestling, he apparently did one where he was like, yeah, how you doing there, George? Uh-huh. How's Barbara? All right. Yes, 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 the Bush. And something like that. I don't know exactly what it was, but it was Barbara and Bush in the same bit. And the network went fucking ballistic. Absolutely ballistic that Gene Okerlund was allegedly talking about Barbara Bush's Bush is what they said, and so on and so forth. And it was Gene being Gene, just doing his double entendre stuff that got in a little trouble with.
That is hilarious. Of all the things I thought you'd be talking about today, Barbara Bush's Bush is not on the list. Let's talk a little bit about, and this is something we get asked about a lot, the wrestling album. Rick Derringer did a song, Rock and Roll Hoochie Coo. And, of course, I think most people know Derringer's most famous piece of wrestling business is Hulk Hogan's entrance theme, Real American. But Tutti Frutti was on the wrestling album as well. Gene's a part of this. I know you weren't there for it, but you've probably got some fun stories that have trickled down the line over the years, right?
Well, on the wrestling album, Gene did Tutti Frutti. On Pile Driver, which was the second album, is Gene actually did Rock and Roll Hoochie Coo. And Joel Watts, my friend Joel Watts, who came up to WWF with me, produced the video for that. And that's when I actually got to meet and work with Rick Derringer, which was one of the coolest things ever for a 24-year-old kid to be sitting there with Rick Derringer and Rick Derringer playing guitar in slow motion. Just the coolest shit. But that's being around Gene Okerlund and him doing that was just crazy, because he's telling Derringer, what to do on different things. And it was just classic because here's, again, Rick Derringer is a rock and roll god. I don't care who you are. You can debate me all you want, but he is a rock and roll god. And it was really nice to see Okerlund collaborating with Derringer and Derringer actually having the time of day to speak to me. So that was my memory of the Pile Driver wrestling album with Gene Okerlund.
Let's talk about the 1987 Slammy Awards. You were there December 16th, Caesar's Palace in Las Vegas. And Caesar's Palace is a cool wrestling place. I didn't really think about that, but you guys did a WrestleMania there. I know there was Clash of Champions there. And even the Slammy Awards, Caesar's Palace, who knew? Gene and Jesse Ventura are the hosts for this. And Gene is also the co-winner of the Best Head Award, which Jay-Z Flair would certainly take issue with. That title was shared with Bam Bam Bigelow. What do you remember about the Slammy Awards from 1987?
It was a week's worth of rehearsals. 1 week. Being in Caesars in Atlantic City and having to go through every painstaking second of that show every single day. The choreography with the dancers and the guys who had never danced before and or really sang live before. They did the album, you know, in a studio and shit, so they never actually sang these things before. And Vince wanted to do it all live and do it all real, no lip syncing and all that other good shit. And Gene and Jesse were holding it all together. And there was a bit that I was responsible for, which was the fight with Hacksaw Jim Duggan and Harley Race. During the night, there was a gimmicked screen that went down on the stage that Harley and Duggan were supposed to go through. But they were only supposed to go through it on the second live show. The first live show, they were supposed to go around it. And the second live show, we were actually going to break through it. Well, we had rehearsed it a million times, and we were doing the first show. And Harley and Duggan are back there. They're waiting on the cue, and I give them the cue. And before I know it, they went right through the middle of the screen, and we only had one. Thank God for Gene Okerlund, because Okerlund reacted. Okerlund, he did it live. He did it off the cuff. Jesse, if you go back and watch it, Jesse didn't know what the hell to do because he was waiting for him to come around the corner, and Okerlund was the savior, and Gene being on the spot like that was, you put him out there live, and I never really had to worry about Gene being out there live because he would be able to cover whatever was thrown at him, and everybody came back yelling and screaming, but at the end of the day, yes, it was a fuck-up. They just misunderstood. They thought they were only going through once, which they were, just the second show. And it all worked out for the better. Because it was real.
Well, you guys changed your format of the event center sometime in 1988, and Gene is the host of that. Talk about the change that you did here and how Gene was feeling with this new role.
For years, what had been was the traditional interview segments where Gene stood there with the talent and interviewed them for every single market. It was time-consuming, it was laborious, and it had become in some ways a plaything for Howard Finkel, where Howard would have guys do interviews that would never air. And when we started looking at the stockpile of everything that we had, just came up with a better way to do it. And I stole the idea from Mid-South because that's how we had done them in Mid-South, except we did them with actual commentators. We would throw back and forth, and you would do a generic interview with wraparounds. So what it became was Gene being in a studio. Gene would do the market-specific stuff. Hey, Atlanta, we're going to be there this Tuesday night at the Omni Arena. Tickets are available here. Gene would do those wraparounds, and then he would throw to talent, and they would do the same interview, and that interview would air in every market that match was pertinent. It wouldn't be specific to Atlanta, but Gene's stuff would. So it required Gene coming to the studio and knocking all of that stuff out, and it was a lot. To Gene, it felt like a lot more work because he had to come to Stanford. in reality, it was a lot less work for Gene, talent, editors, everybody. But it was just new, and it was different. And then Vince kind of was looking at it like, well, God damn it, if he lived here, it wouldn't be a problem. And that scared Gene to death. He did not want to live in Stanford.
Who did?
Yeah, that's a good point.
Okay. Let's talk about WrestleMania 4. This is your first WrestleMania. It's a big moment. It's a big time for you. And we've done a full show on it in the archives. But I feel like you have to have something you can share with us about Gene from that show.
Oh, Jesus. My first WrestleMania, man. And I'm the producer of the show. I'm 25 years old. I'm a kid. I'd never produced a WrestleMania. I didn't know what the hell I was doing. And Vince had told me, he says, make sure you have production meetings with all of the commentators and make sure that you get with everybody individually and have a production meeting with them and go over everything. I'm like, okay, yes, sir, I got it. So I'd had one with Gorilla Monsoon and those guys, which took about an hour and a half or so. And my next one was with Gene Okerlund. So Gene shows up, Gene comes to the room, and he walks in, and, Brucey, what have we got today? I said, well, I said, let's go over the show. He goes, do we really need to go over the show? I said, well, yeah, you need to know what you're doing. He goes, I'm going to be interviewing guys, right? I said, well, yes, sir. And he's like, got it. All right. See you there, kid. And walked out of the room. That was my production meeting with Gene Okerlund. And he was gone before I realized, what the fuck just happened? And everything worked out perfectly. He did interviews.
Let's talk about Sean Mooney. Sean Mooney is another guy that I really think about this era, WWF. I mean, to me, it's Mean Gene and Sean Mooney from the announcer side. Sean tweeted out, a sad day in the world of entertainment and for the fans of the great at the Gene Okerlund. As I have long said, there was Gene Okerlund, and then there was the rest of us. Rest well, my friend. Hashtag GOAT. I mean, everybody's saying that. Everybody, I mean, not just fans, not just people who were in the business, people who were, you know, his coworkers in that business. They all regard him as being the GOAT. How did Gene handle some of the younger talent? Because Gene's obviously the elder statesman of the group. When a young guy like Sean Mooney comes in, how would Gene handle the young upstarts who were coming in?
With class, and Gene was the first one to lend a hand. He wasn't fearful of his job. He wasn't one to, you know, like a lot of the old timers, when new talent come in, they get very fearful and protective of their spot. Gene looked at Sean Mooney as an opportunity, more free time for Gene and more time for Gene to do other things. So he was there to help Sean every way that he possibly could. And it was, from everything that I could tell outside looking in, was a great relationship. And I relied on Gene to do that. I relied on Gene to help the younger talent get these guys through some of the shit. And he never failed.
Let me ask you this. You know, these days, a lot of guys travel together. So this guy rides with that guy, that girl rides with that girl. Who was Gene riding with when you guys were making town? Did he have a traveling companion?
I think for the most of the time when he did travel with somebody, it would probably be Bobby Heenan, or a lot of times he would travel by himself, but he always would hang out with the production guys. Gene loved to hang out with the crew. He was one of the boys, but he was one of the crew too. And he loved everybody, you know, behind the cameras. So that was Gene's click.
Let's talk a little bit about one of the more famous Mean Gene moments, SummerSlam 1989. You know where I'm going with this. I'll let you take it from here.
Oh, boy. Well, we did pre-tapes. And during one of the earlier pre-tapes that I think it was Bobby Heenan and Rick Rude, in the middle of the pre-tape, the SummerSlam sign had been set up, and it was like masking tape or something that was holding the sign to the wall. And in the middle of the interview, the damn sign fell. And Gene just turns around and was like, well, fuck it. And we cut tape, and obviously we did another one. We got the sign back put up and did another one. Well, we're live, and in the middle of the live show, the commentators throw back. It's Tony Schiavone and Jesse Ventura. Two things happened that night that really were the impetus of what I would use for announcer tryouts for many years after that. In the opening shot, when Kerwin was scanning the crowd, doing the ballyhoo across the crowd, a woman jumps in front of the crane and takes her top off. And it made air. It made air on the live show. Jesse and Tony completely froze. Did not know what to say, and they said nothing, which was even worse. Then from there on this, the same thing happened, and Vince is screaming at him, you know, God damn it, cover it, say something. And Jesse kind of fiddle farted around and jumped on Okerlund a little bit. But it was a demonstration of, for me, that I used many years later, for announcers always to have something. React. Even if it's wrong, react. Because it's live and we're looking for you to pull all this shit together. And then we played the right tape. But yeah, that was a complete, you know, it wasn't Gene's fuck up. It was a truck fuck up.
Still hilarious, though. One of the other things that's been floated around is a screen grab of when you guys were apparently just messing around with Mean Gene and put something up there on the lower third where instead of just saying Mean Gene Okerlund, it said Mean, quote unquote, Tiny Dick Gene Okerlund. Is that a Vince McMahonism? Who would have been having fun in the truck when they put Tiny Dick on the screen?
God, did that air?
Didn't air, but it was released in a series of bloopers a few years ago. And, you know, that same blooper reel had Mean Gene cracking everybody up because allegedly these interviews, while they, you know, were long and people were probably tired through the end of them, Gene kept everybody laughing because he was trying to crack you up. And some of that stuff he would go really, really blue with, so it never made the air. Do you remember any famous Gene stand-up moments like that where you thought, boy, this is great shit, but we can never show it?
Yeah, most every taping session that we had doing All American, they became absolutely insane. And I remember one year for Gene's birthday, we actually got him a stripogram to come to the studio, and they did a strip tease for him, and Gene thought it was something else. It's like, oh, you got me a girl. Thank you very much. It's like, no, Gene, you can't keep her. She just have to sit there. She's going to strip over here. And I remember afterwards, because he sat in the chair and she stripped for him probably about 3 or 4 feet away. And she's like, came over, you know, put her clothes back on and gave me a little kiss on the head. And he looks at us all like, that's it. That's it. That's all I get. And it was just, yeah, typical Gene. And we, yeah, most of his stuff was pretty blue, but it was a lot of fun. And when you're working all those crazy hours, you think about it, man. You've got 20 different script writers writing scripts for everything that everybody says on the air now. Gene did that shit off the top of his head where we would sit and look at a show and I would go, okay, here, we're throwing to this. Got it. And he would just do it and make it entertaining. So it wasn't anything as a producer that I did to get it out of Gene. It was, I had a natural talent that I could depend on that would make shit entertaining. And that was Gene Okerlund.
Outstanding. A lot of those, interesting interviews are floating around right now. There's been some posted with Ken Patera and some with a lady wrestler, and I won't give you a spoiler there, but there's some fun stuff out there. Let's talk a little bit about Survivor Series 1990. We've covered this in the archives, but it's another famous Mean Gene moment where I feel bad for him a little bit. It's where you guys have him debut the fucking gobbledygooker, and then Gene dances with him in the ring. what was Gene's takeaway from the fucking gobbledygooker?
Gene's takeaway was everybody else's takeaway, but Gene had a front row seat for it of, what the fuck is this? And when we rehearsed the damn thing, we didn't have, I don't think that we had the head on the gobbledygooker, so you really couldn't understand him, and we kept doing it for him. So it was, you know, Hector saying, gobbledygooker, but we were doing gobbledygooker, damn it. And it came across even worse live, but Gene had fun with it and he went out and Vince wanted him to do some somersaults. And he's like, just can't do that, Vince. I can't physically do it. If you want me to take a bump or do the somersault, I'll never get up. And I think he did one or two, but it was absolutely horrifying. And Gene embodied that moment so much with his reaction to it, because it was a, what the fuck am I looking at? And you felt it all over him.
It's amazing. So one of the other things I wanted to talk to you about is the Ultimate Warrior. You're never short on opinions there. And Gene has said the Ultimate Warrior was the most impossible guy for him to work with on interviews. And you were just sort of describing how Gene made it a breeze for everybody. And if they could do it, he would do it for them. But when it came to the Ultimate Warrior, it was like we've heard this story before. Any interesting Mean Gene Ultimate Warrior stories you can share?
No, Gene just didn't want to work with him because there was nothing for Gene to do. And as soon as Gene would start to do his job, whether it was selling the event or selling the local venue or whatever, Warrior would come in. And Gene would try to hold the microphone, and he would walk around behind him, and Gene would try and wrap it up, and Warrior would just keep going. Where Gene finally said, what the fuck am I doing here? Just let him do his shit. It's ridiculous for me to stand here and do this. So there was a frustration there, but that's the only guy. You know, Gene looked at it as a challenge on some people to try and get interviews out of them and put words in their mouth and make it good. And Warrior just was the impossible almost.
Give me an example of a guy like that.
A guy like Nails, sometimes a guy like Greg Valentine could be challenging. Ricky Steamboat was not the greatest promo in the world. So,
right.
Dino Bravo, Frenchie Martin, some of those guys, you know, it was painful to try and get interviews out of them, but you had to get something with them, and Gene would put the words in their mouth and make it entertaining. Mr. Fuji. It was not always that easy, boy son.
You know, we've heard through the years, especially back in the day, that when you're just champ, Vince wants to talk to you all the time. You know, you go from, you know, Vince is there, but you don't have a ton of interaction with him. Maybe you have a TV here or there, whatever. To when you're the champ, you have a lot more communication with Vince. And I'm sure Vince feels that way because this is really sort of the face of the company. When you think about the amount of TV time and the relationship with the viewer, Mean Gene Okerlund was also sort of a face for the company. What was his relationship like with Vince once they really got up and going?
Great. I mean, really and truly great. Vince trusted Gene. So just as I stated before, you could give Gene something and feel confident that he was going to deliver. So that relationship was one of trust. And they liked each other. They had a good time together. They would go out and party together. It was a mutual respect and they genuinely liked each other. So that helped. But most importantly, I think that there was respect and trust on both sides. That Vince trusted Gene and trusted his judgment that whatever he was going to do was going to be the right thing.
Well, and the right thing is to take care of your money and be a good steward with your money. And Bruce, you've got a tip on how some of our listeners can do that, right?
Hell yeah, because Robinhood, it's an investing app, and it lets you buy and sell stocks, ETFs, options, cryptos, all commission free. So even if you're a stock market newcomer, you can invest for the first time with true confidence, man. It is so easy. When you go to their site, it's easy to navigate. It's easy to get stocks. Like I said, even if it is your first time. Now, other brokerages charge up to $10 for every single trade, Robinhood does not charge commission fees, which means you can trade stocks and you keep all your profits. And with a clear design and easy to understand charts and market data, Robinhood lets you place a trade on your smartphone in just 4 simple taps. I've done it. I have the app installed on my phone. I check it every single day. As a matter of fact, before we got on today to tape, I actually did a little stock buying myself over on Robinhood. And right now, Robinhood is giving listeners a free stock like Apple, Ford, or Sprint to help build your portfolio, not your portfolio. And all you got to do is sign up at wrestle.robinhood.com. That's Wrestle, WRESTLE, dot Robinhood.com to get started with Robinhood. Do it today and start saving with Robinhood.
Vince wrote about Gene's passing. It was impossible not to crack a smile whenever Mean Gene Okerlund entered a room. He was the voice behind so many of WWE's most iconic and entertaining moments, and the WWE family will miss him immensely. And I think one of those famous moments that everybody remembers, and I know you weren't there, Royal Rumble, 1992, Ric Flair's cutting a hell of a promo with a tear in my eye. It's a big moment. The NWA World Champion, finally, the WWF Champion. People have waited for this for a long time, and what would happen if Ric Flair went to the WWF? Well, he's here, and for the first time ever, the winner of the Royal Rumble becomes champion, and it's the Nature Boy. And in the middle of all that, put that cigarette out. And we still get questions about this literally every week. I know you weren't there. What do you remember about it? I'm sure you've talked about it or discussed it with somebody at some point.
Yeah, I discussed it with you when you showed it to me for the first time a couple years ago. And I laughed my ass off because it's in the moment live, and there is no way to go back and edit that. It lives forever. It's one of those classic moments. So all I can imagine is Pat Patterson or Jack Lanza being backstage at the time and smoking a cigarette, or maybe one of the crew guys, one of the extras on the crew, sitting there having a cigarette and Gene catching it out of the corner of his eye. I don't know what happened, but that's probably what took place at that time.
What do you remember about the skits he did with the Bushwhackers? Well, I think Tony Schiavone even may have produced those.
No, I produced the ones, the original ones, and it was some of the most fun because Vince had this vision for the Bushwhackers, and most of it involved eating and getting really messy. So everything that we did, Vince wanted the Bushwhackers to get Gene messy as well. So it was a lot of fun kind of going around Stanford to different locations and allowing the Bushwhackers to bushwhack whatever was in their path. And after a while, Gene had fun with it. Gene didn't like getting messed up, and especially didn't like all the sardines and crap. But that was a shitload of fun, and after a while, Gene started contributing to that. We did stuff with them on their initial vignettes, and then we did stuff with them at Busch Gardens, where we had them kind of going through the animal kingdom and different things like that that Okerlund was a part of. But you could put Gene in any situation, and he'd make it work.
Let's talk about when he couldn't make it work anymore. His final appearance with the WWF is on Superstars, September 18th, 1993. And Gene has gone on record as saying his contract expired and he simply wasn't offered a new one. And he said he probably could have sat down with Vince and came to some sort of deal. But his agent had already been talking to WCW, so he decided to go there. This is happening at a time when the business is definitely on the downswing. You know, everybody knows the tough times that are ahead for 94 and 95. And here at the end of 93... one of the guys who's most closely associated with your brand, his contract expires. You're there at the time. Was this just a business decision and you couldn't afford to keep Gene, or why was his contract not renewed?
It's exactly what it was. If Gene was going to remain with us, it was going to involve a cut in pay and probably a reduction in a lot of his workload as well, but it was definitely going to involve a reduction in his pay. And Vince didn't want to stand in his way. And didn't want to insult him either. So I think it was just a mutual parting of the ways for business at the time.
How did Vince take that? Was it just very matter of fact, we can't afford him, so he's got to go? Or is there some sort of, God damn it, we got to find a way to keep Gene?
I've never heard Vince. There never really was. It was just strictly business. His heart, I think his heart hurt a little bit, but he moved on. In business, he just moves on. But I think that at the, after all was said and done, I think it just hurt a little bit to see him go. But there was nothing we could do to keep him, because he wasn't going to take a reduction in pay, and it was a better deal for him to go to WCW.
But here's my question, I guess. I sort of had an idea the way you were going to answer that before you did, but why not even just offer? I mean, what's wrong with just being honest and saying, Gene, we've had a lot of great... Okay.
He did. And gave him the blessing to go and look for something else.
Gene mentioned that when he left, he gave Vince a hug in his office. How does Vince process that, do you think, when you've got a guy who's been with you for 10 years and he was with you when you built this company to just monumental heights and just made more money than you could ever imagine for yourself and your family and all the families that are associated with your brand? But now, well, the business has seen better days and that guy's leaving. And this is at a time when, you know, Hulk Hogan's left and we know the Macho Man departure is coming the next year. Guys who are really closely associated with the brand, Bobby Heenan, they're out. But Mean Gene was always there. You know, when Hulk Hogan's gone to make a movie, Gene's still here. Chat me up. Does Vince just compartmentalize all of this? And is that how he's able to just sort of keep it moving?
Exactly. You just have to keep moving. If you stop, then you're going to get swallowed up. So you keep moving, you wish him well, and you move on. But at the same time, it's a family, because you spend so many hours together. You work so hard together. You can't help but have feelings and become close with people. So that part is hard, but you have to put on the business hat and just keep moving forward.
What was the reaction internally, you know, like amongst the boys, when they see that a guy who's been here so long, like Gene, is leaving? Does that create a state of panic for any of the guys?
I wouldn't say panic, sadness, yes. And I think that from my vantage point, I definitely know from the production guys at the studio, they were really sad. They were upset that Gene left, because he was one of the boys. He was one of the crew, and he was someone that always hung out with him. We always had a really good time together. So there's just sorrow. I mean, it's just genuine sadness when someone that you love is leaving you.
We've done a bunch of these shows where we talk about guys who sort of fall out of favor with Vince for whatever reason. And that's really what this show is, I guess. It's just peering into the mind of a madman, the one that created the WWF, or, you know, however we want to categorize what we're doing on this show. But one of the things I've always been fascinated with is how Vince can really process all of this. And something that didn't come to light until I was doing research for the show this week on my flight over is his last couple of years in the WWF, he wasn't on speaking terms with Vince. I mean, that's direct from Gene, that he wasn't on the best speaking terms with Vince. Was there some sort of falling out that maybe we haven't ever really discussed? Or was the stress and pressure of the business just getting to Vince at that point?
No, and it was, I don't know that Gene may have characterized it that way, but Gene didn't have any interaction with Vince because Gene was doing things at the studio. Gene wasn't on the road with us all the time at that point. He would come in every once in a while, and he just didn't have that interaction with Vince that he used to have. So
do you think that is a move that Vince makes preemptively when he knows he's going to have to sever the relationship?
No, it just was like, it was just simply a the way that we were doing business at the time, and so much of what we had done on the road, so much of what Vince used to be involved with, he was no longer involved with. And a lot of that went over to the television production side. And what we were doing is, like, we would write TV, we would go and produce it, and then we were pretty much hands off on a lot of it from the production end of things. And that was Kevin Dunn and his group. Gene was mainly working with Kevin and the guys on that end of things. He wasn't working with us on the front end of it. Gene was more on the back end of it. So the relationship and the just the interaction, not relationship, but the interaction with Vince was no longer there because Vince wasn't producing that stuff. Where in the beginning, he did.
Right. Let's talk about him jumping ship here. It happens November 6, 1993 is when we first see him pop up on Saturday night. So not a ton of separation. Does Vince or anybody in the company feel some sort of tinge of, I don't know, maybe ownership's not the right word, but hey, he's supposed to be our guy. He shouldn't be there.
It stings. It's always going to sting. Especially someone who is as notable as Gene Okerlund, because he was the guy that was on everything with us. Saturday night's main event, everything we did, it was Gene Okerlund. So, yeah, it stung. But, again, you can't dwell on it.
Meltzer wrote about Gene's leaving, of course, and he said, Gene Okerlund, who came along with Hulk Hogan or David Schultz on the first Vince McMahon quote-unquote talent raid of the AWA in late 83, appears to be severing ties with the group after nearly 10 years of on-again, off-again employment. Eventually, he would say, no other details are available other than word reaching us that Okerlund was unhappy with the new deal offered by the WWF, which may have included having him move to Connecticut full-time. His WCW deal was reportedly for $250,000 per year, plus 35% of the 900 number. And allegedly, that's true. I've actually picked Eric Bischoff's brain about the hotline business on 83 Weeks. And he said that, yeah, the rumor and innuendo that Gene was a partner on the hotline is accurate. It was found money for WCW. There was almost no revenue or traction there before. So if Gene could grow it, then Gene deserved to participate. And he did a great job at it. Allegedly up to $500,000 a year that thing would generate just from people like the listeners to this show, myself included, who would call in and want to hear what Mark Madden or Mean Gene or Bobby Heenan or whoever was saying. $250 a year, obviously that's a lot higher than what the WWF was offering. Do you believe that the move was something that was discussed there in 93 on that contract offer that you said that Vince did make at a reduced rate, or is that Meltzer freestyling because he knew it was a hot button for Gene?
Well, I don't understand the question. Was what
moving, like, do you think that part of the one of the stipulations in this contract that you said Vince offered him that ultimately he didn't take, do you think that moving to Connecticut was part of that?
No. At that time, I don't believe it was. And I think that more than anything, it was if we were going to do something, we would have to do it at a reduced rate than what you're currently making. And Gene wasn't interested in that, and he had the other offer out there, and Vince was going to stand in his way of the other offer.
Did you stay in touch with Gene when he went to WCW?
I did not. I saw him a few times, but it wasn't something that – no, we didn't stay in touch. I know that there were different overtures over the years to folks in the production company and the production side of things to come back. But no, I personally didn't stay in touch with Gene. The next time that I had any real interaction with him was at WrestleMania in Houston for the Gimmick Battle Royal.
Well, let's talk about that. WrestleMania 17, 2001. He's going to do commentary with his longtime close personal friend, Mr. Bobby the Brain Heenan. And the Gimmick Battle Royal, you're involved. WCW has only been down for a little while. How does this come to be?
The whole concept behind the damn Gimmick Battle Royal was going back and getting every gimmick that there was, you know, putting them in this one Battle Royal. Then it became, how do we make it even more special? I believe it might have been Kevin Dunn's idea to, do we want to go back? God, wouldn't it be great to have Gorilla Monsoon back here to call this thing. Well, through the years, as I had mentioned, Gene had made overtures about wanting to come back. Kevin said, Gene's available. Gene would be perfect for this. Well, who else would be perfect for it is Bobby the Brain Heenan. So Kevin reached out to both of them, and the deal was made. They came in, and that opened the door for them to come back and kind of come back into the family and do some things with, at the time, what the hell was it, WWF 24/7? You know, that thing on cable, and so there were some new programming that they could contribute to, and the rest, as I say, is history. Gene returned.
Yeah, so not only did he do the classics on demand, but the Madison Square Garden classics for the MSG Network, and he did a lot of stuff for the Vintage Collection in 2008. This is pre-network, but they're certainly laying the groundwork. The Legends of the Round Table and things like that all are on the network now, and he's got a big role in a lot of those. He finally gets into the Hall of Fame, inducted by his longtime close personal friend, the Immortal Hulk Hogan, in April of 2006. And during his acceptance speech, he said that he wanted to steal a line from Bob Knight and be buried face down upon his death so his critics could kiss his ass, which I thought was tremendous.
And that's classic Okerlund.
He also managed to go ahead and induct his other longtime close personal friend, Mr. Howard Finkel, into the Hall of Fame in 2009. And there was a series of old school promos that we saw in November of 2010 where they did like an old school episode of Raw, and they had Gene in full nostalgia interviewing guys like John Cena and Randy Orton. And that sort of kickstarted a new movement to sell like nostalgia versions of the WWF logo. Of course, they couldn't call it WWF, so they just chopped the F off, but they got the two W's in there and really doubled down on nostalgia. And I know you weren't there for that, but there's nobody better for that spot than Mean Gene, right?
Absolutely. And I'm going to go back because you had asked me earlier about people that Mean Gene traveled with. In his early days of traveling in the company, I'm remiss if I don't mention this, it was with Howard Finkel. And Howard and Gene traveled up and down the highways and the byways every day. And that is what Gene says contributed to his drinking and growing old a lot faster than he absolutely should have, was traveling with Howard Finkel all those years. But that they were traveling partners early on when they were doing the individual localized interviews every day in a different market.
Gene would pop up sporadically, WrestleMania 27 in a segment with The Rock and Pee Wee Herman, SmackDown in April of 2012, another episode in December of 2012, this time for Raw, where they're doing a Slammy Match of the Year award. He appeared at Mae Young's 90th birthday party in 2013. He did the old school Raw in 2014, where they did like a wrestling hotline spoof. He injected Mr. T into the Hall of Fame in 2014. And then maybe the most recent thing that we all remember about Gene was Legends House, which is available on the network. And I don't think they'll probably do another one, but man, it was super fun to sort of see these guys in their element. And I had by the time that show aired, I had met Gene and hung out with Gene a few times through Rick, and boy, that show really captured who Mean Gene really was. I think most people talk about this a lot, but he may or may not have enjoyed alcohol quite a bit, and may or may not have had some kidney complications. And he and Rick would talk about how after Nitro, they would have to head to the bar and have about 18 clear ones, Conrad. And I don't know why, but that cracked me up. But Gene's drinking was legendary. Any good Mean Gene drinking stories you can share?
Wow, that I can share. See, you know, I saw that caveat in there. I think that one of the funniest was when we were at a brand new hotel that we were trying out in Stamford, Connecticut, a really nice high-end hotel that for some reason was giving us these incredibly great rates. After a particular evening out with Gene tried to hug a several thousand dollar vase, or vase, as you like to say. And it came tumbling down with Gene in his state of maybe having one or two too many vodka martinis. But that was few and far between. Gene liked to have a drink or two, and we had a lot of fun out in the bars and what have you. But he was always a blast. And going back to that hotel, they immediately took that rate away from us and asked us to please not book anything in their hotel going forward after that night. But he was a lot of fun, man. Gene was an awful lot of fun.
One of the things he, well, it's probably not him, but somebody on his behalf, is he tried to get over the phrase "holy balls" on Twitter. Was that a Gene-ism that maybe I didn't ever hear?
I've never heard that.
Well, I tell you, it caught me by surprise earlier this year because I saw Gene in a Mountain Dew Kickstarter commercial with Kevin Hart, who I believe in the commercial is trying to impersonate Randy Savage. And I think the last time we saw him on WWE TV was in January, where he was on the 25th anniversary episode of Raw and he's interviewing AJ Styles. That was probably your last time or next to last time seeing Gene in real life, right? I know you saw him at the 25th anniversary of Raw in New York. We saw him there, and then we saw him in Winston-Salem at WrestleCade. Any final lasting memories of Gene you want to share with us about your last few visits with him?
You know, I remember going back to the 25th anniversary of Raw. I remember that evening when Gene was getting ready to go out and talking to him, and him just saying, you know, wow, they've got so many writers and so many people running around. Remember how we used to do it? And we kind of chuckled, you know, reminisced a little bit. And then he looks at me and says, "Bruce, I don't know any of these guys. I need them to write it down for me now. And they're telling me, Gene, you got it. I don't know who the hell I'm talking to." And that was typical Gene. And then he pulled it off like the champ that he is. The last time that I saw him was this past November in Winston-Salem. And I'm, you know, the last thing that I did was kiss him on the forehead and said, "I love you, Gene, and I'll see you later." And had I known, you know, it was the last time I was going to see him. But I'm glad I got to tell him that. And we were sitting there at the bar when he was having dinner before we went to go do our show. And I invited him to the show, and he was tired. And I just got up, kissed him on the forehead, and told him I loved him.
Wow. Well, let's wrap things up here. Unfortunately, we lost Mean Gene on January 2nd, earlier this week. He survived by his wife of 54 years and two sons, Todd and Tor, three grandchildren. Todd is a professional hockey player with the New York Islanders. Obviously a true legend and an icon in the wrestling business, and lots of people throw those words around, but they're never more deserving than with Mean Gene. What do you think Gene's legacy is going to be?
Well, it isn't going to be holy balls.
No.
You know, I will always see Gene holding the microphone with that other hand up in the air, and I will always picture him standing next to Hulk Hogan and getting Hulkamania over to the level that it got. I mean, Gene Okerlund, as I've said, he was the best, and he's what everyone aspired to be.
Let's let you guys ask some questions. We took to social media and said, "Hey, call an audible. We're going to be covering Mean Gene this week. Do you have a question about Mean Gene? If so, just head us right here." Catherine wants to know, who did Gene love working with and who were his least favorites to work with?
By far, Hulk Hogan was probably his favorite by a long shot. His least favorite was probably Warrior and Savage.
Savage? Now, why Savage?
Just because Randy could be Randy sometimes and be a little off-putting, and just Randy could be Randy could be intense sometimes. And Gene liked to have fun, and Randy wasn't in the mood to have fun. Was what it was. But they got along. I'm just saying, as far as working with them and being predictable and unpredictable.
T-Lo Brown, not D-Lo, this is T-Lo, once said, was there any talent that Gene had heat with backstage? Seemed like he was pretty well liked across the board. Did anybody really not like Gene?
If they did, I never knew about it. No, I think Gene was really genuinely liked by everybody.
RJ Sargent wants to know your best memory of being on the road with Gene. He sort of told the drinking story earlier. You got any good ribs that Gene either had played on him or played on other guys?
God, not off the top of my head. You know, Gene was one of those guys, always liked to have a good time, but Gene was the one that would break the tension, and Gene was the one that kept everybody laughing. When it was late at night and you still had two shows to go, Gene was busting everybody's balls, kind of ribbing on the square, but he was just a pro. He could get you through it.
Daryl wants to know, what's the best Mean Gene moment that got left on the cutting room floor?
I think that if you went back and took all of Gene's "fuck this," you'd have a pretty good long reel. The best stuff was the things when he would just completely go off the rails with his 1 minute bits, and we'd have to say, "God, you know, no, we can't go there. You can't do that." But a lot of it was just some of the blue humor that he would do in the confines of the studio for All American Ins and Outs.
This is from Rand. Did any of the boys intentionally try to make Gene crack up during their promos? We've seen a lot of this where the guys are trying to really make the other ones laugh. And I think some people were commentating on a press conference in wrestling that recently happened where it looked like the guys were trying to make the other ones laugh. Do you remember anybody who always made it their mission to get Gene to crack or vice versa?
I think Piper always used to kind of pride himself in seeing if he could get him to break character a little bit. Roddy was definitely good at that.
Donnie wants to know, is there ever any real-life heat between Gene and Bobby Heenan? They always seem to be taking pot shots at each other on the air. So I always wondered if they really didn't like each other or if they're just two friends joking around.
They were the very best of friends inside and outside of the ring. That's what made it so good.
That's what's so fun to me is I get messages all the time, listeners to this show, who think that you and I just legitimately hate each other. To the point where when we were on vacation recently, I ran into a listener who said, "Oh my God, what the hell are you doing here?" I said, "I'm just on vacation." And he's like, "You go on vacation?" I don't know why that made me laugh, but I said, "Yeah." and then he said, "Who are you here with?" And I was almost embarrassed to say, "Fucking Bruce." It's like, people don't believe that you and I are friends in real life. So that question stuck out to me. Brandon wants to know, in your opinion, Bruce, who had better chemistry with Mean Gene, Hulk Hogan, Ric Flair, or Randy Savage? I don't think Randy's in the conversation.
Hulk Hogan.
Hulk Hogan, really, better than Rick even?
Yes.
Okay. John wants to know, did the WWF ever have a problem with Mean Gene's 900 rumors line when he was on the WCW shows where it seemed that he was far too often applying rumor and innuendo about WWF stars?
I think that there were times that we were miffed at some of the things that were reported, but again, that was, man, we're in the middle of a war, and we were lobbing just as many back the other way as they were our way.
Kenny wants to know, did Mean Gene ever appear in Houston during the brief time the WWF and Paul Bosch worked together in the summer of 87?
His appearances were through videotape when he would interview Nick Bockwinkel, who was the AWA World Champion, and Bobby Heenan when they would come down and have matches in Houston. So Gene was, in that way, he appeared, but not live.
Jason wants to know, what was Mean Gene's finest work, and why was it All-American Wrestling with the Brain?
You know, I think that Gene's finest work was his stand-up interviews and his stuff promoting the towns. To me, that's Gene Okerlund. That's what he was best at.
Nick wants to know, how many or who were Gene's best friends in the WWF? You've told us Finkel. You've told us Bobby Heenan. Is there another name?
I think Hogan.
Okay.
And that pretty much covers it as far as his very best friends that he was really close with.
Randy wants
Kevin
to know.
Dunn, I'd have to throw him in there.
Randy wants to know your favorite personal moment or memory with Gene. So not necessarily something that was on the air, just something between the two of you.
Well, I'll tell you what, it was actually something that was on the air, because it was, we did a special for USA Network, and the last line of the show, Vince had wanted the line to be that Sergeant Slaughter was the greatest natural leader since the great General Saddam Hussein. And Okerlund was like, fuck you, I'm not going to do it. I'm not going to be out there when somebody does it. Gene didn't want to be a part of that angle in any way, shape, or form. So Gene and I did it, and we were doing it, and we had like one take. I don't think it was live, but it may have been. But it was the very last segment of the show, the very last bit of the show. And in as Brother Love, I did it with Gene, and Gene knew exactly where I was going. And he was like, basically, you son of a bitch, you got me. And I got the line, and right afterwards, that was his line. He goes, son of a bitch, you got me. He goes, thank God we weren't out there. But I did it because it was backstage. And Gene was just, that was one that he was fearful of, the whole angle with Slaughter and everything. I enjoyed working with Gene.
Well, let's keep it moving here. We've got tons of fun questions here. Tom wants to know, what was the best advice or lesson that Bruce learned from Mean Gene?
Wow. Get it done. Do what you have to do to get it done. It when the world's crumbling all around you, there's shit to be done. Get it done. And that was something that I learned. When I would panic sometimes. When I got there early on, I didn't know what to do because of all the different personalities around me. So I would start to try to please everybody. And Gene took me off to the side one day and says, Bruce, do what's in front of you and get it done. This is what we have to do right now. Let's get this done. Worry about all the other shit later. And I think that kind of sticks right up there. He and Gorilla Monsoon both helped me so much in that way.
Charlie wants to know, did Gene regret going to WCW?
I don't know. I don't think so. You know, hell, he had a good run there. I don't think so at all.
Sean wants to know, what was Gene's drink of choice?
Vodka martini.
Robert wants to know, whose idea was it for him to always wear a tuxedo in the WWF?
That was just something that Vince always did early on. He wanted all of his announcers and commentators to stand out and wear tuxes, be classy.
Devin wants to know, did they ever consider giving Gene a Piper's Pit style show?
No, that wasn't Gene's role. Gene was the neutral guy. That wouldn't have worked.
Jay wants to know, did Bruce ever have a Mean Gene burger?
Can't say I ever had the pleasure of having a Mean Gene burger.
Ryan wants to know, nothing salacious or scandalous, but any funny Mean Gene party stories? I got to tell you, it does feel like Mean Gene would be the best guy ever to have at a party.
Well, he is, and he was the life of the party. And like I said, you know, I think that the fun times, I don't know how funny it was, but Gene always was the life of the party, whether he was telling jokes or whether he was at the end of the piano singing. And that was who Gene Okerlund was. Just a lot of fun.
Last question here. This one's from Robert Collins. What was Gene Okerlund like in real life?
What you see is what you get in many respects. But he could also be very, very reflective. One of the nicest guys that I've ever had the pleasure of working with, one of the most talented individuals ever in the business, because I just had confidence in him and I trusted him as well. And he never let me down in that regard. So to sum it all up, he was a good father and he was just a really, really good man. And there's not a lot of that out there. And I think that Gene fits in that category.
Without question, the greatest to ever do it, the best that ever did it, Mean Gene Okerlund. You'll be missed. We appreciate you guys taking time to join us here on the show and celebrate the life and times of the great Gene Okerlund. And hope you'll be back next week when we're back to our regularly scheduled programming. We'll hit Royal Rumble 1999 next week. But in the meantime, let's relive some more Mean Gene memories. And we'll post some videos on YouTube and Facebook and everywhere we can to celebrate the great life of Angie Nelkerlin. We'll see you next week right here, Something to Wrestle with Bruce Pritchard.
When you have sports mixed with your pop culture, along with humor and celebrity interviews, your earbuds are enjoying the Rich Eisen Show.
Kevin Millar, we're all paying rent in Ohtani's world, right?
And the Dodgers world. Game is healthy. Game is good. And, you know, I get asked a lot, is that good for baseball? Yeah, it's good for baseball. This is definitely the team to beat, because that should be your next question, Richie, is that, is this World Series a bust for the Dodgers and Dave Roberts?
Hell yeah.
Search for the Rich Eisen Show on YouTube or wherever you listen.